All right, welcome back to another episode of We All Speak in Poems. Today I'm sitting down with Liam Higgins, a director and writer from Toronto. In this episode, we're talking about him shooting the Alaskan Tapes video Wake, as well as shooting commercial jobs, photography versus cinematography, and inspiration in general. I hope you enjoy it. I want to start really quick with Wake in general.
Okay.
The film that we sort of did together. Mm-hmm. Even though I was pretty involved with it, I still don't know really how it came about. Like, obviously me and you met for coffee, chatted for 3 hours about death metal and skateboarding.
Yeah. I was going to say a variety of different things along the course of just interests and things like that. Yeah,
exactly. And then all of a sudden it started and we were trying to figure out what songs we were going to do and we wanted to do the solo piano thing. But once I finished my song and the ambient version of the other song that we did, what happened after that? Like, how did you find Martin was the director, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, kind of to go back, I guess, for in terms of starting and things like that, like I wrote Wake over the pandemic and
Right. Basically
like at the time that I had wrote that piece, I didn't always have in mind that it was going to be a very musical centric piece. Like before I was just kind of like, I want to make a short. I know how I want it to look. I know how I want it to feel just based on like, you know, at the time, like what I was really aiming for artistically. And then from there, I guess, I don't know, like I just kind of naturally progressed towards like thinking about every element of the production, like not only just the cinematography, but like the audio, the sound, like everything across the board. And I mean, it kind of came back to thinking about like the tone of the piece and the way that I wanted it to feel. And originally it was actually supposed to be a piece that was surrounded by Theme for the Cross by King Cruel.
Okay.
Yeah. And so we really loved in that song, there's like a lot of very somber sort of like granular piano sound. And I really, really liked that. And that was kind of like why I wanted to move in that direction, because it was mixing sort of sound and cityscape with like granular piano sounds and like really, really just like dark kind of melodies and things like that. And I really, really enjoyed that. But when we kind of came down to it, like when him and I spoke about it, I was like, yeah, I'm like writing this piece and like, you know, give me some time to like write something that maybe isn't about King Cruel, just because it is a bit of a stretch to like want to do something on a more freelance capacity with an artist that like maybe you don't know.
Yeah.
Or like maybe one that's like seemingly out of reach, right? So with that, that was kind of like when I reached out to you and I was like, well, I love your stuff. And like, for me, it's like, when I was even like from the earliest phases of writing movies, like before I did Wake and before I did other ones, I always had like songs from like Explosions in the Sky and Godspeed You Black Emperor and things like that in mind, because I thought their music was very cinematic.
Yeah.
But it was also like not maybe in traditional sense, like music for movies, like things like Hans Zimmer and Max Richter and things like that. Like I didn't really feel that it was on the same level as those kind of things. It was like a different sort of indie music path version of that.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, this is the stuff that I love. Like I would love to find an artist to collaborate that was, you know, kind of more in that lane. And that's when I found you. And when we spoke about things, like I said, it's like we hit it off pretty quick. We talked about like music, skateboarding and movies and different things like that, and photography, right? So yeah, it was just kind of like a natural blending of things, I guess, right? Because bringing Martin on board, like Martin's a very visual director. And like when I kind of came into the script already, like knowing like literally what I wanted to do a lot with it visually and everything like that. And Martin's kind of expertise outside of directing is being an editor.
Okay.
So, and I feel like I'm pretty good on the editing side, like knowing how an edit should flow, but I think Martin's like really, really good at it. So like when I was working with him and talking with him about it, like he seemed like a very collaborative partner that would be good for the project, but one where it's like there wasn't going to be so much ego involved. Mm-hmm. So it was like really going to be a nice free-flowing collaboration for the most part.
Yeah, because that's pretty much what I got from it, was like even though you're credited as the cinematographer, you really did take the reins and like sort of doing it. I know that you wrote it, but I feel like you sort of brought everything together yourself. You know, it was your project.
I would say that it, you know, in large part, obviously, like, you know, when you write the thing, you are kind of like, you know, for the most part, like taking a lot of responsibility, especially like in an indie sort of like bootstrapped version of filmmaking, right? But I would honestly say like Mike, the producer, and Martin were like huge collaborators and actually making it a reality, because they kind of, in ways, like I was very like starry-eyed about what I wanted to accomplish with it and like had all these major ideas. And then they were both there the whole way backing me on it, but then also being like perfect example is like one of the locations was, at the time that I was with my partner at that time, we were driving through Wasaga Beach. Oh. And I saw this beach. I was like, oh, you know, I have to kind of like find these beaches, right? And for the film, and we went out to Wasaga Beach, and she just like showed me this beach. She's like, yeah, it has a crazy sunset. This is actually a part of like basically a part of like a line, in not like a coastline, but you know what I mean, something along a river line or whatever. For and sure. Around the bend, there's a beach there literally called Sunset Beach.
Okay.
And she was telling me about like how iconic the sunsets were and like how it's like kind of known for its sunset. And like that was really the most important part of the piece. So I remember seeing that sunset and being like, this is the beach that we need to shoot out for the film. Nice. But it's like 2.5 hours away from Toronto. And when I told that to Mike and Martin, they were like, 100%. Like there was no like, oh, I don't know if it's not going to be possible. I don't know if it's going to be, you know, it was very much just like, yes, we'll do it. We'll make it work. We'll find a way to make it work. And that was kind of just, that's just kind of an inkling of like what working with them was like, right? It was like, as a director and as a producer, they were really supportive of the vision. And same thing with Martin, as much as he was kind of part and parcel handling the direction with me. He was a very collaborative, understanding, and like flexible partner to work with, right? So,
man, that's so sick. Yeah, it sounds like a lot of the projects, like the ones that you find actually come to fruition and get finished, are the ones that are easy to work on, right? Like it was like this with you, I really didn't have to do much, right? It was the same with Places, like Andrew handled that. And it's really sick. But going back to the locations, that's something I want to talk about too, because a lot of the interior ones were done near like Niagara, right?
So the interior locations, we shot this house. It was an abandoned house in Mississauga.
Oh.
And then we shot this church, which was in Toronto. It's actually like less than 10 minutes from here.
Oh, sick.
And then the other, oh wait, yes. So no. So the church was in Scarborough. And then the basement kind of like Twin Peaks-esque hell, so to speak, was like 10 minutes from here. So like the whole film, I believe, is four locations, I think. I think it's four locations. I can't remember. The house, the beach, the church, and the basement. Yeah. So it's literally four locations.
That's crazy. Wait. So I want to go back. How did you sort of swing the abandoned house one? Like, how do you get a permission to do that? Do you just go?
So this is the thing. So this is actually a really funny story, because Martin and I at the time, the big thing was like, we were like, we want an abandoned house on the water, which was like, to be honest with you, like for us at the time, that when we were really starting to like think about the locations that we wanted for the film, it was very about like finding a needle in a haystack. Like we wanted to find not only an abandoned house and that was next to water, but also an abandoned church. Like it was very specific locations that were like maybe not super easy to find in Ontario. So there was actually one time where we were actually like talking with like a YouTuber that was like a big urban exploration guy.
Okay.
So we were talking with him, and he was actually the one giving us advice on like how to go about like, you know, finding the people who own these locations, or like, you know, talking with them and like, you know, being able to talk to them about like the premise of why you want to shoot and stuff like that. And he was like really, really, actually at the time, there was a portion of the film that was going to be shot in Montreal because we found a really great abandoned church there that we wanted to use. And then there was a part of it where we're actually going to shoot the whole thing on Vancouver Island.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So there was a variety of different things, but like particularly with the house, the thing that was really funny is that me and Martin, I remember we were sitting together, and I believe in the living room of my old house. I think it was either that or it might have been. No, I think it would have been that, but we were watching these YouTube videos of like abandoned beachside houses in Ontario. And there was this one that we thought was like perfect, and it's the one we ended up shooting at. But the way that we found it is that me and Martin were scrolling through the video, and then all of a sudden he like paused it, and I was like, wait a minute. And I looked in the back and I saw the CN Tower like way off in the distance.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I was like, wait, so if it's like, if that's the CN Tower, then it's got to be on the water line somewhere near Mississauga or Hamilton. So we went on Google Maps and scouted the whole coastline until we found the house, dropped a pin, drove there, found the found on the side the construction company that was like managing the house, called them, and then basically like begged them to shoot. And they were like, yeah, sure. Like, the house is going to be demolished in September. So as long as you shoot before then, like, you guys can do it.
That's so sick.
Yeah.
Like, you never really think about that sort of working out, you know?
It's very serendipitous, for sure.
For sure. Like, I bet they would have a million reasons to say no.
I mean, safety hazard, yeah. Asbestos in the house, potentially. There was a lot of things that when we walked into the house for the first time, we were like, oh, this place is destroyed. Like, it's funny because what you see in the film, like, not really much is adulterated in terms of production design. Like, the roof caving in, like, all the stuff that was, like, not all the stuff, but, like, a good majority of the stuff that was there. There was obviously some production design that Francis, our production designer, brought in with the art team that, like, made it look as if it was, like, slightly more livable. Like, it was lived in at one point. Like, the bed was brought in and, like, the couch and the table was brought in with, like, a bunch of other, like, things that would kind of, like, set up the feeling of it being sort of this, like, withered home, so to speak.
Yeah.
But for the most part, like, the roof collapsing in, the shit all over the floor, like, that was just the way it was. So it was a kind of godsend of a location, right? So
that's crazy. It's such a perfect location too. When you first sent me some stills of that, I was like, oh my god, we did it again, you know, somehow. I don't know how my music gets associated with these things. Like, they're so good.
Well, I don't know, man. I think it's like, you kind of, your music's very cinematic, so to speak, right? And I feel like that's kind of like, it's catered to like a very indie film sort of feeling.
Yeah.
Like, even like, man, think about like when I kind of sent you the description of the film. And you literally, like, you sent me the piano piece back and it was literally a one take.
That's true. Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was literally, I was like, and then when we got in to do the actual editing of the song, during the sort of post-production side of things,
mm-hmm.
like, it was us and me and you sitting down together and being like, well, why don't we change this piano phrase and put it here?
Yeah.
And like, you know, we, at one point we were like, you know, throwing the music through an eight track recorder, mm-hmm. and like doing that whole thing to grain it up, and then, you know, that whole process, right? So it was like we were going back and forth for a while, but like for the most part, it's like you had the piece made. Like, it was just one take.
Yeah, I forgot about that actually, because yeah, I recorded on my phone and I sent it to you, and I was like, yo, what about this, something like this, and you were like, this is perfect, and I was like, I don't know if I can play this again, you know? So I had to like really figure that out. But I think the way that it came out was really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
These sort of minimal piano pieces are so good for, you know, these, for visuals,
mm-hmm.
right? Makes it pretty easy.
Well, yeah. And I think too, it's like, I mean, I can't remember exactly by ear, but it sounded very like, you know, major seventh-esque. Like, it was very like, kind of jazzy, but very like not omniscient, but I'm trying to think of like the right, like very like ominous. It was like a very ominous feeling piece. But for me, it's like the minimal nature of the piano, like especially in the second half of the film, like for me, that really sets the tone for the whole second half of the film. And it was literally just piano and like what felt like a hall space, you know? So it's like, It sounded great. It sounded like perfect. It served exactly the purpose it needed to serve in the film, right? So it's like, sometimes like the simpler things are the better things, right?
Yeah, true.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah. And I love just the way it came out too, with using, because we did an ambient version of O Woods,
mm-hmm.
As well with it, which actually never got released. I should probably release that, that version, but mm-hmm. that's like my favorite song I've ever written. Right. So the fact that we were able to incorporate that into it and then go into the minimal piano afterwards to sort of hit it on the head, like it's the perfect project. It was awesome, and the fact that it was so long, and like I'm really into long form pieces of, mm-hmm. of art and all that, so the fact that we didn't just do a 3-minute video.
Yeah, I mean, and there was also like a lot of subtleties in the music that I think, looking back on watching the film, that like you kind of had, even in like talking about the O Woods piece, like the shot where he's literally like sinking to the bottom of the body of water, like the twinkly piano notes, like, you know, things like that, like the small things that kind of like contributed to making that piece like feel the way that it did. Not even just Wake, I'm talking about O Woods, like the way that that piece felt was just like really iconic. Like, it just felt very full, but like the subtleties like really brought out the depth of the music too, right? So yeah.
And then the actor, his name is Michael Warma, right?
Michael Womera.
Okay, Womera. Mm-hmm. Were you part of the sort of audition process of that? How did that work?
Yeah, so me and Martin had our hands in literally every piece of production. Like, it was me, Martin, and Mike the whole way through, and we really, you know, collectively kind of did everything. And then actually our other friend Julia Batista, she was involved as well, and she kind of helped us tie loose knots and things like that in other places of production. And like, kind of the, you know, we really like came together as a unit, understanding that it was an indie project. And yeah, kind of going back to what you're talking about, like casting. So it was really funny because we actually put out a casting call, and I think we had like 35 auditions for the lead.
Really?
Like, yeah, people just submitting tapes, and like other people just submitting headshots. Very like, you know, just like a very wide net of people. And man, we watched through all of the audition tapes, and like none of them were right. And then Martin called me one day, and he was like, yo, I got this guy Michael who's like really, like, he's really into the idea, and I want you to meet him. We met him for coffee, and like literally after meeting for coffee, literally in the exact same courtyard that we met the first time.
Okay, sick.
When we sat there and we like talked about like you know, male vulnerability, we talked about like actually being able to like correctly display emotions, and like being able to like, you know, be open and like, you know, confident in having those conversations and things like that. And I just knew from like the way he was speaking about these topics, like so eloquently and like so openly, just made me understand that he knew what we were going to do for this movie. And he sent in like a tape after we had met, and as soon as me and Martin saw, we're like, yeah, he's the one, like 100% he's the one. And he's the guy in the movie. Like, he's the, like, the guy who really brought the film to life. Like, you know what I mean? He's where everything that me and Martin were trying to explain through the film is all channeled through him, right? So it's like, it was a big undertaking, but he did an amazing job, right? And I would say even Lauren too, the young girl, like, and Brittany as well, like everyone played a very essential role on screen. Mm-hmm. So like telling the story what it was, but it was like it could have gone in any which direction, but like every single person that came on board like really took to understanding what the concept of the movie was. Even Lauren, like as a young girl, like she was very shy, but she played the role really well. Like, it was very simple, very minimal. She wasn't trying to like, you know, do anything crazy. Like, she was just this timid, sweet young girl who was really nice, and like the whole thing just came together like really, really well. So we got very lucky.
I can't believe that there's that much interest in, I mean, I can, but can't, because I'm not in that world of, mm-hmm, like actors and stuff, but like, you know, it's a pretty small project, you know,
mm-hmm,
and it's so sick that there was 35 auditions, you know, like, it's, yeah, really cool that sort of, I don't know, this scene and this industry is thriving. I guess everybody wants to make it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, that's definitely a part of it. It's definitely like one of those things where it's like, oh, like, you know, a project that maybe isn't a commercial, it's a little bit more creative, it's like maybe something that'll stand out in your portfolio a bit more, right? So I feel like it's understanding as an actor to really want to try and go for that opportunity.
For sure. Yeah, exactly. And then going into Soft, that's the name of your,
yep,
feature film.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't write that, did you?
No, I was just the cinematographer on it. Yeah, Joseph Amenta, they were a first-time feature director, did that film. It's fantastic. Great working with the team on that one. They were really awesome.
What was it like there? Like, did you have much of a creative input there, or were you just taking orders?
Tons.
Oh, yeah?
Tons, which was really, really great because, you know, as it was my first feature that I had ever shot, and, you know, kind of being in being a guest in that space for, like, what the sort of commentary and what the themes of the film kind of represented, like queer culture and ballroom culture, things like that. And you know, coming in as a guest to that space, like, and still being offered a lot of creative input, creative feedback, creative flexibility, Joseph, the director, really gave me a lot of space to really understand what their story was and like how I could contribute something to that visually and understanding what that world was. And you know, obviously there was a lot of conversations back and forth about how the film was going to be approached, but at the end of the day, Joseph like had the best input, because, you know, what I see on screen now is like, yep, you're right, like,
yeah,
was the best decisions made, right? So yeah, that was we shot that, how long ago would it have been now, September of not this previous year, the year before.
Oh wow. So yeah, it's been like a year and a half.
Yeah, year and a half, I think.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's still getting pushed. That's the awesome thing, right? Mm-hmm. You guys are still doing screenings.
Yeah, we're still doing screenings and things like that. It's kind of like up in the air of like what's happening with the film next. Mm-hmm. But from what I know, yeah, we're still doing festivals and things like that, still going through that process and whatnot. So, yeah.
How did you meet the sort of director and writer of that project of Soft? Was it natural again?
No, so that one I actually was very, very lucky. So a couple years ago, I met with a friend of mine, Michael, for coffee, and he's a fellow cinematographer. Okay. And he was actually supposed to shoot that film. And then he got offered another movie. So he called me and he's like, I really want to intro you to this director. I feel like it's right up your alley. I feel like, you know, you would be a good candidate for it. And I was like, for sure, 100%. Like, I would love to, like, you know, haven't shot a feature yet. So it'd be really, really great. And then once that happened, you know, I met with the director and really just like gave it my all, like really became prepared. And like, they were asking me, they're like, did you get a chance to look at the script? And I was like, yeah, I've read it 4 times already. Like, and they're like, oh, and I was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And like, I had like made notes and feedback for the whole thing so that they could tell that I was serious about it. And a couple other of my colleagues and mentors put in a really good word for me to the producers. And yeah, I just remember they had a meeting with me and they're like, yeah, we want you to shoot the film. And I was like, amazing. Like, 100% I'm down. So
it feels like every project that you go into, you're like 200% in, you know, like, where does that come from?
I try to be really prepared. I think there's a couple things. Like, I think one, like, it's a very commonly used, I guess, kind of like mantra or like saying, but like, success is when like preparation meets opportunity.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that, like, for me, I always want to be overly prepared for opportunities just because I want the director, producer, whoever, writer, to know that I'm serious about it. Like, if I read it and I like it, like, I'm 200% in, as you said. Whereas like, if I read it and it's not something that I'm fully into, I'm very upfront about that. Okay. Like, I'm very much just like, yeah, like, I read the script, not totally my bag, but thank you for the opportunity. Like, you know, just as professional as possible. But I just think, you know, when I find something that I love, like, or that I see it and I'm like, this is it, like, I'm 100% in.
That's crazy. So do you turn down opportunities a lot then?
A fair bit, I'd say. Like,
it's pretty sick.
At this point, like, with narrative work, yes, there is a lot of stuff that I turn down just because I am trying to be a bit more selective about, like, because, you know, when you do a feature, like, when you do a feature, it's a long process, right? It's like, sometimes you're shooting for 30 days, you're in pre-production for 30 to 60 days, like, and then there's post and, you know, post festivals, everything like that. And you want to be involved in that process. So like, you have to make sure that, like, when you step onto a project of that scale, that like, you're 100% in.
Yeah.
Right. Because if you're not, then like, I mean, you're doing the project a disservice, you're doing the director a disservice, like, and you want to make sure that you're there for that. You want to make sure that you're present for the project. You want to make sure you're present in everything that you do creatively, right? Because if you're not, then the product suffers and then your name's on that. And like, you know, the director may or may not like feel great about the contributions you made, right? Yeah. So you want to make sure that you're putting your best foot forward, right?
Nice. That's crazy. Like, everything that you're saying resonates with me a lot, you know, like, because like you're saying, if you're not totally into the project as well, you know, you're not going to want to be there. No, you're not going to do your best work, like you're saying, and the relationships that you could be building in another project, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I mean, I would probably say that's the same for you in collaborating with artists, right? Exactly. Like, I'm sure that, like, you know, like, when you think about a collaboration with like Michael Lessard, like, that's something that, I mean, creatively you're very invested in, because you're like, well, not only am I a fan of this guy's work solo, but you're a huge fan of The Contortionist. Like, you're exactly. A huge fan of like the music he's done outside of his individual work as well. So you're like, oh yes, I'm invested in you as an artist. Like, this, the work you do already inspires me, right?
Exactly. And like, there's collaborations and stuff, I'm sure that you've had it too, where you are invested in the artist's sort of life and work, but it just doesn't happen because something doesn't mesh very well. Mm-hmm. Or whatever, and like, it just never gets done. And that happens all the time. Like, that's the reason majority of the collaborations I do never get finished.
Really?
Right? Is because we start to work and then it's like, either we both lose momentum or something just happens and like, we're not working very well together or whatever. And like, I don't want to put anything out that's wasn't fun or wasn't like productive or something you don't feel good about.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know? So that happens all the time.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's completely understandable. Like, you want to be, not even like from the perspective of, I feel like selective maybe sometimes gets a bad rep because I feel like it means you're picky, but I think it's not really even about being picky. I think it's just about being like, this isn't in line with what I want to accomplish.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and it's almost like not quite an image thing, but you can kind of compare it to it. Like, you want to be involved in projects that you want to be involved in, yeah, and you want to be known for.
You. Yeah, exactly. That best represent you and best represent what you're doing. And
yeah, nothing would be worse than like your most popular or successful project being something that you didn't even like, or mm-hmm. you hate being a part of, or something like that. You know what I'm saying?
For sure.
It's like my worst nightmare. And even with music, like some of the most popular songs I've made are the songs that I didn't really care about, you know, and that always sucks looking at. Like I make a song like Oh Woods, I'm so proud of it, like 11 minutes of like pure, this is my best work.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like not even close to, you know, the one people who hear it generally like it,
mm-hmm.
but it's just not the one that gets pushed. And there's a lot of reasons for that, right? Like a lot of the time your favorite work as an artist is not necessarily experimental, but definitely the stuff that you're trying to sort of bend your norms.
I would say the best work in all different creative fields are usually the ones that are very genre bending, right? Or
exactly.
like the ones that kind of veer away from like mainstream conversation. And it's not because I think people are, you know, being like, oh, it's everything popular is wrong, so to speak.
Yeah.
I think that it's just people are looking, well, not, I wouldn't say at mass, but like very like, you know, pockets of artists are like into seeing something that's produced at a high quality of like output, but also passion. And I think that like that's something the viewer can see.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas like if it's something that comes off as very like, whether it's like mundane or like half effort kind of thing, I feel like a lot of people would naturally hear that, right? Because they'll be like, oh, the quality is kind of, you know, it's lesser than, or like it's just you can't feel those intricacies of like I was saying, like the twinkling notes and the piano and Oh Woods and things like that. Like they don't hear those subtleties because it doesn't almost feel like the artist is present.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, and this is why your favorite like pop artist's favorite artist is not another pop artist.
Exactly.
Right? Because it's this awesome little like underground of like people that are just pure making stuff for art,
mm-hmm.
and making stuff for music, and that's the stuff they're getting inspired by and just sort of taking little bits of it to put it into their mainstream stuff. And you know, as I've been making music, it's something that's been really interesting looking into, you mm-hmm. know, like I can't believe this person is inspired by that person. It doesn't make sense. But then you actually listen and you're like, oh, that's where this bass line came from.
Yes.
Or that's where this ambience came from or whatever. You know, it's really, really interesting. Do you find a lot of that in like film and stuff?
100%. Yeah, there's definitely like a lot of people, like there's a lot of people who really, you know, take things from other filmmakers, or like not even like take things from other filmmakers, but like see something they like and try to replicate it, right?
Yeah.
Like, I would say a lot of the visual feeling of Wake was Stalker by Tarkovsky. Like a lot of that was influenced by that. And you know, at the time that I was writing Wake, like I was watching tons of Tarkovsky films like Solaris and Nostalgia and Stalker and things like that. And just being like, you know, the camera doesn't move a whole lot. Like it doesn't, like it's very slow moving if it ever does move. And it's very like contemplative feeling, right? It's, and you know, you find out that Tarkovsky's like really influenced by like the writings of like Dostoevsky and like these different sort of areas of like where his influence came from. And then you also find out too that like, you know, like there's a huge not like a huge conversation, but within the film pockets of the film community, a lot of people talk about how Stalker is a very similar film to Annihilation, right?
Oh, yeah.
And like how there's like parallel there, and like it just so happens that I actually also love Annihilation, right?
Yeah.
So it's like there's yeah, it's like a really interesting sort of like mix of like inspiration and where things come from. But even a really, really great example is like thinking about popular music being inspired by a very like obscure sort of, not obscure even, but like just something out of pocket even. Like one I had posted on my Instagram the other day about this album that I love called I'm gonna butcher the name, I think it's Troppo Bleu. It's like this French funk jazz band from the 70s from France called Cortex.
Okay.
And like Cortex is amazing, I love Cortex, but like they make incredible music, like very, very interesting sounding, like totally like out there and like relevant in terms of like the way it sounds nowadays. But like, you know, that album, it's I think it's a 7 or 8 track album, but like it's, you know, MF Doom has sampled it, Flying Lotus has sampled it, Baby Keem has sampled it. Like it's a very well sampled record because I think people hear it and be like, there's something about this record that like is worth digging into, whether it's the samples or it's the piano lines or just the melodies in general that are perfect for sampling.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, the song, I believe it's 8th of October 1971, I think is the name of this song. It's the One Beer sample from MF Doom.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's like there's, it's a nice little thing in there, but it's Doom's like one of my favorites, and like because of that song, really liking the sample, I was like, I wonder where this came from, and that's what introduced me to that record. So,
man, it's crazy to think about music and art in general in that way. It's almost like a, probably gonna give the wrong like analogy, but it's almost like an economy where like these people are just making things purely for it, and then, you know, other people are coming along and taking it, making it popular. Like,
yes,
it's this weird thing, and if because of the way the industry is now, like, it feels like everything is stolen or taken advantage of.
Yes.
But if the system and all this stuff wasn't like how it is, then it would be like this just pure trade-off of arts, right? It's this weird thing.
Yeah, I think there's like, I think there's a kind of two lanes to this. Like the one lane is that like protect intellectual property.
For sure.
Right? Which I agree with. I agree with, like, for the most part, but I think it's more nuanced than that, because I think, like, the other thing is that, like, if you put something into the universe, or, like, you put something out as an artist, like, you kind of already, like, the minute you put it out into the world, like, other people who are going to be inspired by it are going to see it and, like, maybe pick something apart from it that they like, and, like, you have to accept a certain level of, like, that's now out into the world. Yeah. And, like, you have to think about it, too, from the perspective of, like, when you were coming up, there was definitely work that you tried to emulate. There was definitely work still, that I tried to emulate. Even as a guitar player, there was always stuff that I was emulating, right? And like, I really loved it. Like, for instance, like a lot of my writing style for guitar music now is like very emulative of bands like This Town Needs Guns and like Tiny Moving Parts. Like, I really love the way that they write guitar. And like, I don't try to hide that. Like, you know what I mean? I'm very open about the fact that it's like, yeah, like I'm inspired by these people because I love the way that the melodies are very technical, but they're also very emotional. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we have to be open to the fact that like the information that we're taking may come from a very, you know, very pure place, but it is still at the end of the day, it is taking and reformatting. Like, you have to kind of understand that that's just kind of the microcosm of, or the macrocosm of being an artist.
Exactly.
Like, your work is in a larger pool, and you know, people are going to want to take from that pool.
And I mean, it, when that does happen and somebody takes from your, or it gets inspired by your work and even tries to replicate it, like, that's sick.
Yeah, you know? I agree.
Like, I can't believe my music did that to somebody. Like, somebody who I absolutely love is Taylor Dupree. Mm-hmm. If I could make his album So Me, I would be able to stop making music, you know?
Yeah.
It's one of those things. That's like the perfect album for me. And it's just like, if he heard that, I don't know the way he thinks about this type of stuff, but like, that's sick to be able to hit somebody so hard that they literally wish they made that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's cool.
Exactly.
Right. But like you're saying, there's a lot of like nuance to it, because obviously it's his work. If I came out with another version of So Me, that'd be a huge issue.
Well, and see, that's the thing, as much as you do, you know, in ways where, you know, you may try to emulate Taylor Dupree's work, it'll never be Taylor Dupree's work.
Exactly.
Because there's something specific about what he brings to it that like you won't bring to it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And like, that's, but that's the thing that's interesting, because it's the same thing maybe with you. Maybe a young and up and coming ambient artist is like, I love the music that Alaskan Tapes makes. I want to make music that sounds like Alaskan Tapes, but they need to accept that like part of the journey of becoming a good artist is acknowledging that like you can take, but you never can be, right? And like, for me, that's the humbling thing about being an artist, is that I think that you can acknowledge that there's a lot of information that you can take and you can digest and you can interpret and then, you know, execute.
Exactly.
Right? And like, it's going to be different evidently, right? Yeah. But that difference is, that slight tuning of difference is what makes it yours, right? Like, there's a really great conversation with, I believe, the, I want to say he's the one of the percussion players from the band The Internet.
Okay.
And they talk a lot about them. They specifically as a group are very inspired by like artists like Erykah Badu and D'Angelo. And I remember watching an interview with one of the percussive members of the group, and he was saying that, you know, if you look at D'Angelo's Voodoo versus like Black Messiah, is there's a 15-year gap between the record, but it's just slightly better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just slightly more tuned and slightly more like refined and in the pocket than Voodoo was. But I mean, Voodoo is like a near perfect record. Like, that's like, in my opinion, like that's the heart of like R&B records from the 90s. Like, that's an insane record, right?
So, and that's an interesting conversation too, because to some people it could be the fact that it's not quite as in the pocket and maybe not as refined is what's so good about it. You know, it's like purely from them, you know, and it doesn't have to be this perfect, like, sparkly record.
Well, of course, and I think, like, again, I think what it boils down to is that the most important thing about being an artist is your voice.
Yeah.
Right? Because your voice is the one thing that defines you and separates you, right? And I think, for instance, like, when I think about voice, talking about the D'Angelo record, Questlove talks about how much he was, like, on tour at the time, and, like, he was on tour at the time, and, like, he was watching, or I think Dilla was opening,
okay,
and, like, how he talked about how he emulated his style of drumming after what Dilla was doing, right? And, like, he heard Dilla and was like, he was so used to, like, very tight drumming, like very, very, like, snappy, tight, like things like that. Whereas, like, what he noticed about Dilla was like his use of quantization, but also his use of, like, how sloppy the percussion sounds.
Yeah.
And, like, how that's sort of his signature.
Exactly.
Right? So that's the thing, is it's like his signature then went on to influence, like, a lot of R&B, a lot of hip hop,
like all of it.
All of it, right?
Yeah.
And, like, so that's another thing that's really prevalent on Voodoo, is the fact that, like, Questlove, you know, being the Roots, I believe, or Questlove, are a huge part of that record in terms of productions, like him and, like, Pilo Palladino, and, you know, a lot of these other kind of classic kind of jazz icons of the time. But also looking at the drumming, and he's like, literally Questlove being like, we tapped Dilla for a couple of these songs because it's like what makes the record the way it is. It's like the tightness of, like, the melodies, but then, like, the drums are just so, like so tight but sloppy at the same time, right?
So it's so hard to emulate that, like, because I remember when I first heard Dilla, when I was first starting to make music, I wanted to make it, mm-hmm, you know. So I started trying, and you think it's easy because it's kind of sloppy, but it's sloppy in such a way, in such his voice, that you just can't emulate it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep.
And, like, you hear a lot of people in lo-fi, they're all trying to emulate it,
of course,
and they're not quite there, they just can't. There's something that he did that is just, I don't, it's his voice, like you're saying.
Well, I was gonna say, like, I think about Dilla, like, the only other person to get it as close to him is Nujabes, right? So,
yeah,
like, Nujabes was really trying to do a similar thing to what Dilla did, right? But I think the thing is about Dilla is that, and you can hear it in the music, is the grit. Like,
yeah,
it's it's being raised on jazz music, it's being raised on Motown, mm-hmm, right? And, like, coming from a place like Detroit, and, like, just how that had such a massive influence on, like, the music that he was sampling and the music that he grew up around, and, like, Conic Gardens and things like that. And, like, that being the kind of epicenter for how his sound developed. It was, like, really about, like, him acknowledging his environment, but then also at the same time, like, pulling all the things that he was inspired by and then taking the things that he liked from them and making them his own, right?
And this is the big difference about taking inspiration and, I guess, stealing, right? Because, mm-hmm, when you take your inspirations, like what I did, right? Growing up, I was just into metal. And essentially, when I started making ambient music especially, I just wanted to make the interludes between the songs that could actually, like, heighten the emotional impact of a deathcore record.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Like, the Contortionist did that really well, you know, on their, I guess, their latest album, but that was like 5 years ago at this point.
Yeah. That wouldn't have been Languages, would it?
No, that was Clairvoyant. Yeah.
Intrinsic was the last record that I really, like, metal wise, like, from them at least, that I was like, okay, yeah, like, I really like this record. But Exoplanet's a perfect album.
Oh, for sure.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's in kind of what you're saying. Like, there's this beautiful meld of, like, ambient sounds that remind you of, like, you know, celestial events, so to speak. Like, the whole, yeah, album was themed around space, right? And it was like, it was metal and it was heavy, like tracks like Oscillator, and, like, you know, they're heavy tracks, but then you have these more down-tempo tracks like Egress, like those,
yeah,
last,
exactly,
three songs at the end that were, like, more melodic, and they were more, like, ambient in a way. So I can understand how that would be really inspiring for you.
Yeah, and there's even, like, As I Lay Dying has that song, This Is Who We Are, and they have that, like, piano ballad at the end of it. And that was really inspiring. That was the first song I ever learned on piano,
mm-hmm,
when I was, like, 12 or 13. And it was just little pieces of that type of music that I was like, there's more here. And even, like, Bring Me the Horizon did all those, like, chill step remixes,
yep,
back in the day,
yeah,
you know? And as maybe bad as they are now. Back yeah, then, to a 16-year-old, it was amazing, right? Sure. It was this whole other genre, and it was like, oh, you can do dubstep and electronic music, but you can also make it like this, you know? And I guess that's how I got introduced to, like, downtempo, you know? It's through that type of thing, but wanting more of it and not being able to find it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Tycho came up and all the chill wave stuff.
Yeah.
But it's just really interesting. You can really tell when an artist tastefully wears their influences on their sleeve. You know what I'm saying?
Very, very true. Yeah, I mean, like, were you born in Oshawa?
No, no.
Where were you from originally?
Just pretty close to it, Whippy. So I guess it's pretty much Oshawa.
Okay, so this is what I thought, because I thought it was Whippy, and I was like, did you grow up listening to Protest?
Yeah, oh yeah,
right?
Of course.
So Protest is like, I mean, look at all the music that Arif wrote, like, for that group, right? Like, looking at, like, an album like Fortress and Kazaiah, and, like, the amount of, like, piano and ambient influence on those records. Exactly. Too, like,
jazz,
jazz even, yeah. Right, because it's funny too, because, like, there was a group, I'm from Windsor, right, and there was a group that was from Windsor when we were younger called Assassinate the Following.
Okay.
And the one of the guitar players from Protest managed Assassinate the Following.
Okay, cool.
And Assassinate the Following's music is, you know, for the lack of a better term, like a Protest the Hero ripoff, right? And it was very obvious, right? So I think, kind of with that in mind, there's a certain balance about wearing your influence on your sleeves.
And it's interesting, because, like, the same thing that happened to Dilla with all the lo-fi people wanting to emulate him, happened to Meshuggah with the whole gen genre.
Very true.
And still happening, right? Like, it's really interesting when a band comes along, you can tell they're influenced by Meshuggah, but they're not them. They're not trying to be them. You know, it's really cool, and you can see that a lot in every genre of music.
Well, it's actually really funny. It's like, I have this conversation with some of my musician friends sometimes about, like, metal music in general, and how, like, a lot of metal, I mean, as much as people want to admit it, like, metal, the only reason metal exists is because of Black Sabbath.
Yeah.
Like, Black Sabbath is, like, literally the group that defined what metal is, right? Because, you know, if you go back and you listen to recordings from, like, Volume 4 and Masters of Reality, like, that was all of the stuff that influenced, like, stoner punk and, like, all the stuff that was, like, slow, like, kind of, like, you know, metal, so to speak, right? And it's just an evolution from there. So when you talk about a band like Meshuggah, you're like, yeah, like, Meshuggah was the reason bands like Volumes exist and, like, you know, things like that. But I would see, if you look at the technical prowess of a band like Meshuggah versus Volumes, like, I don't mean to shit on Volumes, but, like, I hate that band. Like, I really do. Like, and it's not because I think they're a bad band, but I think that, like, Gent, I think there's it's a spectrum, right? With, like, if you look at Gent, like, technically bands like Periphery are Gent influenced.
I mean, they just came out with an album called Gent Is Not a Genre.
Really?
Yeah, I know.
The irony of that.
I know.
But Periphery, totally a very technical band. Whereas, like, if you look at Volumes, not very technical.
Yeah.
Very production heavy and, like, things like that. But again, like, technically, like, a lot of, I mean, nowadays, well, not even nowadays, but I remember back in the day when we were listening to the Gent bands, we were like, oh, if they play in Drop A, they're a Gent band.
Yeah.
When in reality, like, you have bands that are Gent centric that weren't Gent focused. Like, a really great example is looking at a band like Structures.
Yeah.
Remember the band Structures? Like, very heavily Gent based, but super technical. Very much more in the lane of progressive metal.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And if you want to get even more, like, popular, Animals as Leaders.
Which, I mean, Tosin Abasi is, like, one of the best guitar players to walk the earth.
They're a great example of somebody who tastefully wore their influences on their sleeve.
Very true. Well, I mean, he's also a classically trained guitarist, too, right?
True. So,
I mean,
so he's taking Meshuggah, classically trained guitar stuff, and probably everything else.
A myriad of different things,
and
right?
Bringing them into one thing instead of being hyper-focused on this one thing you want to emulate.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can hear that. And, like, a really great example is, like, I remember when I would used to sit at my computer and work, there was somebody had wrote a piano transcription of On Impulse.
Okay.
And, like, I remember hearing that song on guitar and be like, man, this song is, like, really nice. And then I heard the piano transcription and I'm like, this song's beautiful.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Like, you hear it from a different instrument and you're like, whoa, like, not only are, like, the melodies and, like, the polyrhythms in the melody to the actual bass line so complex, but it's also, like, they move so beautifully. Like, it's almost like I think about On Impulse, like the actual, like the breadth of that song musically and theoretically is like Avatar. Yeah. It's so wide and so expansive, and like the world that he builds in that song with the just the melody purely is like so intense. And then it goes all the way to like basically emulating that same melody in like an ambient format all the way to a metal format and just building it kind of in the same way like bands like Between the Baron and Me do it too.
Yeah,
right, where it's sure. Like Between the Baron and Me is like openly admitted that they're heavily influenced by bands like Phantomus and Dillinger Escape Plan and like, you know, bands that are like, you know, on the surface like very jazz influenced but heavy, right? Yeah. Very heavy. Like Mike Patton is, you know, an iconic musician. He's done movie. He did the music for him and Atticus Finch did the music for Place Beyond the Pines.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
Yep.
And so this whole conversation wraps around pretty easily to cinematography and the stuff that I think you grew up on as well, skate videos and yep. all this stuff. Like, do you find that that stuff really influences the work that you do now?
Not so much. So I think with skateboarding was for me, was like really the foot in the door with filmmaking, because I mean, you know, when you're going out and shooting videos with your friends, you're learning Premiere, you're like, yeah. you know, you're doing the things that like kind of are at the base roots, like the root of it all, like what kind of is the starting steps for an indie filmmaker, right? Like learning Premiere, learning how to use cameras, like learning, you know, how to shoot things and like how to like, you know. It's the same thing when, like, you know, we owned the VX1000s when we were growing up and you're like, oh, I want to be Beagle. It's exactly. the same way that a young filmmaker's like making their films and like, oh, I want to be like Christopher Nolan. Like, you know what I mean? It's the same thing. It's just a different set of influences. Whereas like nowadays, like I feel like a lot of my influence like kind of comes from like certain cinematographers, certain filmmakers that I okay. feel emulate the style that I want to be putting out now, because I'm actually in a pretty transitional phase visually.
Okay.
Like I think because like Wake was sort of the thing that brought me into what I wanted to start doing, and then since then I've been slowly starting to implement it from project to project, but like Wake is sort of the grand sort of grandiose, I guess, so to speak, like direction that I want to go, right? Which is like thinking about like composition more and thinking about like not just being super conventional, but like thinking about, you know, where is the camera going to go and like how is that, what you're seeing in the camera, how is that actually going to like properly display the emotion and properly display what you want from a story perspective, right? Because like yeah. I think about, like, I always made this joke is that, like, so many people talk about, like, these crazy lighting cues and, like, this crazy lighting movement and all this big camera moves and jibs and all these things. And it's like, I did all that stuff on yeah. commercials and music videos and, like, barely got any recognition for them. And then I create a film with a 31-second lock-off shot and yeah. it wins awards for cinematography. Like, it's so back. It seems backwards, but in realization, I don't think it is. Like, I exactly. think it's because there's so much intention behind it. And I think that's what like markets, like, I think that's what's the making of good cinematography is intention.
Yeah.
And like, it's the same thing with filmmaking or like writing music that you care about. It's all rooted in intention. Like, what's the intention behind it? And like, is the intention to like do a big camera move or like have this big, like symphony behind the thing? It's like, or is it the twinkling piano notes at the end of a woods that are the intricacies that create the intention? Right?
Exactly. And that's what I found when I was going through your commercial work, before this, like, it's crazy because some of the commercials that you've done, I'm like, wait a minute. I see these every time I watch the Leafs game. You know, I'm like, what the hell? You shot this? But, you know, they are like the dolly, like spinning things and all this crazy stuff. Yeah. And I'm like, this doesn't seem like him. But is it fun for you, like, to be able to do a commercial shot knowing that you can do all like the gimmicky things?
So the funny thing is I don't really classify them as gimmicky, because the thing is that like, it's just in terms of the project, it's the tool that's right for the job.
I see.
Right. So in the same way that, like, you know, for Wake, it's locked off cameras and like subtle dolly movement and like things like that, for the commercial, it is a little bit more of this higher visual energy to captivate the audience. Right. Like, a lot of it is built with intention behind it still.
Yeah.
It's just a different direction. Right.
I see.
So when I think about how, again, intention is built into a commercial versus how it's built into a narrative, it's, you, when you think about a movie, if you think about like an hour and a half long movie, like if you're doing stuff like this for an hour and a half, like, you're going to nauseate people, yeah. right? Whereas, like, if you watch a movie and, like, maybe you see a shot like that, it's really slow and subtle and it kind of catches your attention. Like, thinking about filmmakers like Gaspar Noé, like, did Enter the Void, Climax, like, different movies like that. Like, very visual film, like, very, like, obscure visual identities for those films. It's like, yeah, there's intention behind it, right? Okay. Yeah. Whereas, like, a movie that, you know, might want to... Like, I think about a film like Columbus, Ohio. Like, Columbus is a great example because, like, that film is, for the most part, a very locked-off film. And it's, like, a lot of the shots are very architectural, right? Which is the kind of epitaph of the film is architecture, right? So it's, like, yeah. it's, again, it's built with intention, right? So it's, like, it really is a thing where as long as you build intention behind whatever you're doing, like, yeah, it may be different on a commercial versus a feature film. But, again, like, if you see a treatment, a script, or something like that, and you're, like, oh, this is the direction that I want to go, or this is something that's in line with what I want, then you can build intention behind it.
This makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. I'm going to start using this sort of, like, I don't even know what to call it.
Mentality.
So to speak.
Yeah.
Man, that's sick. Yeah. But speaking more about commercial jobs mm-hmm. and stuff, do you use it sort of in the way to fund your passion projects?
I think so. This is the thing that I've kind of come to the conclusion about with, you know, different projects. They all serve a different function in terms of what they mean to me in my career or what they mean in the grand scope of things. But, like, I think in the grand scheme of things, a perfect world for me is, like, features and commercials. Like, I love features and commercials, and then the occasional music video.
Okay.
Because, I mean, as somebody who, like, operates in the label system, music videos, there's no funding.
No.
Right?
And the thing is, yeah, there's almost no point to them anymore.
Well, see, this is the thing, is like, this almost. Is actually a discussion. This is a discussion worth having, because is there a point or is there not a point? Because I think what it is the industry needs to reevaluate how they're using them.
Yeah, that's
right. Fair. Because I think the main thing is that, like, there still exists a model of, like, people think of it very black and white, being like, oh, music videos are commercials for the artist.
Yeah.
They are, but, like, they're also like ways in which, you know, like, basically you can have creative and collaborative partners that best sell the brand and the identity of the artist. And, like, I evidently, like, that's nowadays in the modern music world, that's a huge part of what sells your music. It's not just the music. Yeah. It's the character behind the music. And how else are you going to display that, right? In an open form, like a video format, right? Where, like, people can go and watch the music videos and be like, wow, this was so cool. And, like, people do watch music videos, right? Like, and they're actually, like, a great form of marketing for artists, which...
Exactly.
You know, it's a competitive space nowadays, so you have to have good content.
Yeah, my thoughts on it... So, I hear it every day, you know, at work and through my A&R and stuff. It's just not worth it to do a music video, all this stuff. But I seriously contribute my success to building an identity, or at least a visual identity, for the music.
Mm-hmm.
When we did Wake, absolutely. it gives an image to Wake. When we did Places, it gives an image to Places. Mm-hmm. And yeah, not a lot of people might see it or whatever, but the people that do, it sticks with them. You know, it builds the picture of Alaskan Tapes more in their heads. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's no real value, like, there's infinite value in that.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's going to be in 30 years from now. Wake might be the thing that people remember, not an album that streamed well.
Well, yes. You know, that's interesting that you say that too, because I think one of the things that also attracted to me about wanting to work with you as well is looking at the credibility of the filmmakers that you were working with, people like Norman Meredith and people like Andrew, and being like, not only is the music just absolutely incredible, but the stories that are being built with them are gorgeous and they're meaningful. And, like, they're coming from a place of passion where you get to look at, like, a person like Norman Meredith, like people like Norman Meredith, who, like, create incredible work across the board. And then now you're getting to see that mixed in with what you do and exactly. being like, oh, like, wow, like there's so much greatness here. And, like, there's so much, like, good here. And then it's like, you just remind yourself of how grateful you are to have those collaborative partners. Right.
And that leads to other things, you know, like in music, you really can't just rely on, you know, streaming. You can sometimes, not a lot of artists can. So those things have brought in composition work for me. They've brought in licensing for me. Like, the fact that Wake was used in this type of film, mm-hmm. or and that's, like, the official one.
Yeah.
other films like this or commercials like this with this mood and stuff want that song. And whether or not they're going to license it is a whole other discussion, but they'll ask the composer, make something like this.
Exactly.
I've seen it with, and even just the mood of the song, I've seen it like Eden wanted to do a music video like Places. Mm-hmm. Like, and so they asked, oh my God, I'm going to blank on their names. It's a director couple from the UK. Anyways.
Us?
No. They're really great.
Director couple from the UK. Okay.
They did Eden stuff. And it's really great music videos. But I know for a fact that they were influenced by Places, like color schemes and like mm-hmm. the vibe of it.
The very organic color scheme of that piece. Yeah.
And it's just, once again, you can't put value on that. Like,
yeah, you really can't, man. Like, see, that's the thing is like, I'm very, 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 very much more inspired. Like, and this is the thing too, is that I think like from a filmmaking perspective, like I'm inspired more, like, I feel like people have a tendency to kind of be like, oh, my influences are this or my influences that. And I would say that a lot of my influences is very fluid, like, yeah, in terms of where it comes from. It's not just, you know, filmmaking, it's music, it's writing, it's art in general. And like, that's why when I look at films where it's like, because I feel like I have a wide net of inspiration from different things, like I feel like there are no limitations in where I look for things. So sometimes, like, you know, like when I hear music or when I hear things like that, and it's like when you get to collaborate with people who have such a refined palette for taste, it's like that's where I think the most beautiful work comes from, right? Because I think that was like a huge part of our collaboration, was like being like, I'm like, Brady's good at knowing the emotion in the music, and like I have a vision for how I want that to look, and like it's just the two of us coming together with Martin and with Mike and being like, okay, like visually, like how do we want to accomplish this, like how do we bring it together, and then we bring it together and we make it work, right?
This is sort of what I've always said about ambient music in general, is something, there are a lot of compositional ambient composers that are really great, but for the most part ambient artists are just curators, right? Like, my music isn't complicated. You know, a lot of people can make my music, but they don't, because they don't have the same curative mind that I do. Mm-hmm. I see this, I want to bring that into the song. I see that, I want to bring that into the song.
Yeah, it's the same way the DJs do it, right?
Kind of,
building,
yeah,
sets, like knowing what transitions work, things like that. Like, what's, you know, what's going to change in terms of tempo and the energy of a set, things like that, which is going to bring it down and then bring it back up. And,
exactly.
You know, it is all about curation for sure.
And, you know, that's obviously overly simplifying things, because, you know, synthesis is a whole other thing that you need to know how to do, and yeah, composing
sine,
in general.
Sine waves and things like that.
Yeah. You know, whatever that stuff is.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a really interesting sort of conversation.
Yeah, for sure. No, without a doubt. I think that whole kind of aspect of like just knowing the technical prowess of whatever craft you are, like you do, and the research that goes behind that, it arguably is the most important thing. Because I think, you know, like for instance, like watching a film and like knowing like how something was accomplished and being like, I do really like that. Like, and then being like, okay, they probably did it this way, right? Yeah. And then using that and implying that to whatever you do, or like applying a version of that to how you do it, and exactly, how it applies to what you do, versus like same thing with you. You might hear something in a song and being like, oh, they probably did this.
Exactly.
And then trying it and being like, okay, yeah, this fits well here.
Exactly. It's exactly how I've been using generative music lately.
Generative music?
Yeah. So essentially music that can go on forever, that never repeats, you know?
Interesting.
A lot of people do, and it's really cool. Like Brian Eno, his first stuff was like generative. Music for Airports was generative, you know?
I love Music for Airports, man. That album is so good.
Yeah, I mean, Music for Airports 1 is just like, everybody loves it.
The piano.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's just, yeah, I don't even know. It's just interesting stuff, man. And I love being able to actually speak about it. But, you know, you've done Wake, you've done Soft, and you've done a bunch of commercials in, you know, in between. Is this sort of the direction that you're continuing going in the future? Like, you're doing features, like you were saying, in commercials?
Like, for sure. Like, definitely, like, the, obviously, like, always, like, a mix of things, I think, helps, you know, stimulate the brain in different ways. And obviously, commercials, like, help you pay your bills and things like that as well. But I think, yeah, for me, like, wanting to, you know, centralize myself more as an artist, working on feature films and things like that is kind of like where my heart is, just because I feel like that's where I'm working optimally in my craft, is like, you know, being able to sit with one project for a couple months and really stimulate myself in the world of that story, in understanding one thing versus like, you know, sometimes on in any given month I'll have like five projects and like, you know, you're spreading yourself thin,
yeah,
right? So it's like months where like I can have more of like a bearing to be like, yeah, are you working on a feature for the next 2 or 3 months? Like that for me is like, okay, great. Now I can like just focus on this.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Right? Because then, you know, your needs are, for the most part, your needs are met, right? And you're consumed with one thing at a time, right? Like obviously, like, you know, it's good to have a variety of things. And like the way that I've always kind of placed it, and one of the mantras that I was going to say before was that like, if feature films are like powerlifting competitions, then like commercials are going to the gym.
Oh, okay.
Because it's like, you can do so many commercials all the time, yeah, that it's like, and they're all different in their own way, that like, if I'm doing 3-4 commercials in a month, those 3-4 commercials could be all vastly different and require different tools, different crew, different ideas. And at the time that you're also expanding your network, you're also like refining your capabilities in a certain area of the craft.
I see.
Right.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. That's sick, man. Yeah. I just want to say thank you for coming on to this.
Oh like, man. No, yeah, no problem. Yeah. Honestly, like I've, you know, I love hanging with you. So
of course,
and chatting with music and different art and stuff like that. So I'm working on a new film right now. I'm writing a new movie right now. And, sick. That one's going to be a little bit more of like a hefty workload just in terms of like accomplishing that. So I've been writing that and then, working on a couple other films right now. I have another feature coming up that I'm doing.
Wow.
And yeah, that's like pretty much it, commercials and whatnot in between then, but for just sure. Yeah, I think what I'm kind of, for a personal identity sake, yeah, like this next movie that I'm writing right now is going to be a bit of a hefty workload, but
sick.
Definitely very excited about it.
Amazing, man. And yeah, you usually like talk about all this stuff on your Instagram and stuff, right?
Yep.
So whoever's listening, follow his Instagram.
At Liam Higgins on Instagram. Yeah, but
Oh, man. Amazing.
Yeah. Dope, man. Yeah. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of We All Speak in Poems. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd appreciate a follow or like on whatever platform you're listening to, as well as going ahead and following Liam Higgins on any social media platform that you use. Catch you again in 2 weeks.